Welcome to From the Producer's Office, a series of informal podcasts with Opera Holland Park's Director of Opera, James Clutton. In conversation with creatives and collaborators, we explore the process of putting opera on stage and how the artists involved approach their craft.
Hello, welcome to From the Producer's Office. I'm James Clutton, Director of Opera, Opera Holland Park. It's a bright October morning. I'm sitting in the club in the middle of Soho talking to two guests this morning. It's sort of my version of the relative values column in the Times. I've got a conductor who's worked for us this year at Opera Holland Park, George Jackson, and his dad, Philip Jackson, well-known actor and more or less the A to Z of every film or TV show you've ever loved over the last 20 years or so.
A slight exaggeration.
Good morning, both. Good morning, both. How are you?
Good morning.
Good. George, let's start with... Well, I'm going to open this up quickly. I normally open the dialogue up by saying, you know, to George, did you have classical music in your house when you were growing up? But on this occasion, I can turn it around. Philip, did George have classical music in the house when he was growing up?
No, is the short answer to that question. But that's not fair, because there was a bit. I mean, Radio 3 was off and on.
Right.
And I can't remember what year it was, but I definitely had an interest, because when Chapel's music department closed in Bond Street,
right,
there was a massive sale of vinyl records. Cool. And I remember going in there a lot and buying a lot of stuff
right.
at a very reasonable price.
Right.
And so George will testify there are lots of quite well-known legendary recordings on our shelves because of that sale.
Well, it's funny that, because obviously we're talking between friends, but saying no is a short answer, but then that's a big thing to have. A lot of classical music records in the house, and particularly if you play them or not, they're around and people get used to seeing them. George, you remember any of that?
I remember, funny enough, I was listening to the Van Morrison Chieftains album.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that, the Irish Heartbeat album? And it's like a soundtrack of growing up.
Yeah, really?
At home. And so it was much more non-classical. Lots of blues, lots of Rolling Stones, lots of Pink Floyd, lots of Van Morrison. And
that's true.
There was classical stuff. I remember when you got those, can we call them vinyls?
Records.
Albums.
Because I remember... Because I didn't really know much about classical music. You know, I had no idea of what a symphony was, what a concerto was.
Mm.
But I remember you playing me, I think it must have been one of the Mozart concertos with, I think, Daniel Barenboim. It was part of the collection.
Yep, Deutsche Grammophon.
Deutsche Grammophon.
Yeah.
And I remember you saying, like, the thing about a concerto is that you're going to hear the orchestra, and then, dramatically, this piano is going to start playing at the front. And that sort of stuck with me.
Wow. Good memory, yeah.
I don't remember that.
That's really nice.
That's
a nice
memory.
What a lovely memory, yeah.
I mean, I tried to start playing the piano before you were born. That's true as well. Go there in a minute. But at the age of probably about 30, and I didn't get very far. There was a strike, an ITV strike, and I was contracted to a TV series in Manchester,
right?
And of course we laid off and weren't allowed to do any other work because we were still under contract to them,
right?
And I thought, that's a project to do, so I didn't actually do any grades, but I did have a teacher and sort of went in, and that got me interested as a grown up.
And that was before George was born.
Yes, it was, and about 10 years before.
So
it was on my mind a bit. I was sort of interested, but didn't. And Sally and I would. From concerts now and again, not crazy about it, but you know.
Yeah. But let's go to you, Philip, on this anyway, about being an artist, being an actor. Let's turn the question back on you. Was there drama and was there performance in your family when you were growing up?
No, there wasn't. It was a very conventional childhood. My father had a shop in a small town in Nottinghamshire, and my mother sort of worked with him, and I think they got a bit of a shock because I was at local grammar school when we started doing sixth form. I think they were quite taken aback when I was like bringing home Racine and Molière and German literature
good school.
In the language
good
well,
school,
good
then,
school.
Yeah.
I like languages, so I mean I don't think they knew how to deal with it because it was beyond their thing. And, you know, but that all came through. I didn't do music at school, but I don't know, the drama thing was in the 60s. It was a lot of people were looking for alternative ways of spending their lives.
Yeah, and that kind
of came up because we did some plays.
And was there a big thing about that in your family then when you said to yourself or to them, I fancy being an actor?
Well, I think they were horrified. I think
really?
They thought it was completely insane. And I think because I went to university, I did joint drama and German degree.
Mm.
And I think because I did German, they thought I'd be in the Foreign Office or something like that. And in fact, it was the drama element came through. They came to accept it, and actually, I think my father was rather proud of it in the end when he could talk to his mates and say, "Oh, my son was." You know what I mean? So.
But it is a big jump. It still is. George, how was your dad? I'll ask him in a minute. How was your dad when you started looking to go into the arts as a career?
I mean, I think it. I mean, it's not similar in the sense of being completely different work-wise from you, but I think it's still a world which is separate from your world.
Yeah,
you know, in terms of the people that are involved in it and the music itself. You know, so in a way, I mean, it's not the same, but I definitely feel like you're visitors to the world that I've been involved in, and probably vice versa as well with the acting world as well. But no, I think there is always just support and just sort of go and do whatever you want and have a nice time.
Well, it always feels like that when I see you both, but I mean that sort of question of is more in that way that because you're saying about your parents, Philip, but and my parents are very supportive. I had nothing in my background about being in the arts at all.
Mm.
But it is still, even to this day, 2021, even more so, it's a difficult career in the arts. It's not your average, you're going to get a salary every month type thing. So it's fair enough for parents to be worried.
I think
that's
their fear, really, that it would be it's not a proper job. But I mean, that you might suffer. And in the early years, you know, I remember they used to come and see some very small flats that I lived in London, be quite horrified by the conditions. But they supported it.
Yeah.
I always remember George told me when he was, I don't know, he was probably about 9 or 10, that they'd done a thing at school where the people were talking about what they want to be when they grew up, and somebody walked in and this lad put his hand up and said, "I want to be a financial advisor." Do you remember?
And he now is a financial advisor.
And I thought, well, I know George is not going to say that.
Fantastic. That's great that he is. You know.
Yeah.
So, George, when did you think, music is my thing? Were you an instrumentalist before you were a conductor, or was it straight to being a conductor?
Yeah, I mean, at the beginning, I did learn the piano for about a year and a half, 2 years maybe, and I refused to practice. I just wouldn't practice. And so you very, I think, rightly said, well, there's no point in you having lessons unless you practice.
Well, I think the teacher did.
The teacher said,
fine teacher, Mrs. Hunt in Ealing, and she said, well, you can't really carry on with this unless you practice.
Yeah.
I remember I was there at the lesson.
But what was great is that you allowed me to just stop. Because that gave me kind of quite a lot of responsibility as a 6 or 7 year old.
We're talking that young.
Then a few years later, I suddenly was really interested in playing the violin, and in a way, the fact that I was interested in that came from me wanting to do it.
Yeah,
I never had any pressure like a lot of kids. The parents would say, "Right, you have to practice."
Yeah.
You know, it was awful. I used to do 2 or 3 minutes a day,
right?
And then I was always the one getting the phone calls the night before the music exams, saying like, "I really think that he's going to fail." And then I practiced at the last minute, and usually it was okay. It was.
You've always been a bit like that.
Exams
and tests and things.
But then I joined the big thing for me was I joined the local youth orchestra, Ealing Youth Orchestra, and
to play violin.
Yeah. And part of the reason was that a really good friend of mine, who's still, actually I was his best man a couple of years ago, violinist Thomas Crean. And funnily enough, I went to this, before the orchestra, I went to this party, and it was like one of the best parties I've been to as a sort of 15, 16 year old. And it was the after show party of one of their youth orchestra concerts.
Nice.
And so I thought, right, I'll have to join. so I joined. And I had about 2 years, and we went on lots of big tours, European tours in the summers and stuff. And it was there really, rather than at school or anything, that I sort of, I remember going into the first rehearsal and seeing, it was Sibelius' first symphony on the music stand, but it was the actual real, the parts that you get from, I think it was probably Westminster Music Library.
Right.
But it felt like we were playing the real thing.
Yeah.
And it was this kind of amazing thing of also meeting other people who, you know, we'd all go to the pub and talk about the symphony. It was just this really weird sort of approach, which I didn't know.
But it is a thing of, I think it gets a bad rap when you're outside of the arts, because it is a very collegiate acting, I don't know so much about, but music industry, it's a very collegiate thing.
Oh, fantastic.
And you have to be with people and trust them. Okay, you sometimes are intensely involved with people for 2 months and then you don't see them again for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
But there has to be a level of trust, and it's a very interesting side of the business, and I think something that we've all missed over the last 20 months or so. Do you think that's right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very, so the whole idea of an orchestra and people playing together is a very social event, and that's what I like going to see concerts now, is just watching how everybody's like in the moment and listening to each other and part of that thing. I mean, I know you said sometimes when you've been in certain countries in Europe that you don't get the post performance social stuff. Like,
is that right?
Well,
it depends on the orchestra.
It
really depends on how well you know the orchestra as well. You know, that also varies a little bit as well. There's always a bit of a barrier. I mean, that's why opera can be so fantastic, because you're all sort of in the same boat
the
way through.
I think that's absolutely right.
It's quite different.
So, Philip, for you, when you go and see George conduct, do you get nervous?
A little bit, yes, I suppose I do, but I know he's very good at what he does, and I know
indeed.
He prepares a great deal. So
Better than he did for his exams, I
guess. Yeah, but he'd still make it work, even if he had to study all night the night before.
Right,
was his thing. I mean, I don't know, talking about when he did piano when he was very young, he decided when he was in university that if he was going to be a conductor, he ought to have piano.
Right.
Having not done it since he was five or six, whatever you were. So you rang me up one day from Dublin and said, I'm going to do some piano exams. You said you were going to do piano grade.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, so what are you going to, this is the age of what, 17?
Yeah, wait, yeah.
No, 19. Well, no, 19,
20,
You said you're going to do grade, and I said, oh, so you're going to start at grade one, are you, and work through? And he said, no, I'm going to do grade 8. It's very typical of George's. And I said, well, will that work? Because, you know, you haven't had all those years of doing scales, and muscle memory of scales and arpeggios and all that kind of stuff. Will he be able to do it? Well, to cut a long story short, he did do it, and he got a distinction.
Yeah, okay.
So
he worked very hard.
End of
story.
Worked
very hard.
I didn't know any conductor. I didn't know how to become a conductor, but I knew that I was interested in that.
I'm going to stop you there, John. Why?
Yeah.
That's the big question I was going to ask you. Why interested in conducting right at the very beginning?
I think I started being interested in composition because I suppose I liked composers. I liked new music. I liked what was going on. And then I sort of realised after studying it for a bit that actually I have nothing to say in terms of music that I could imagine or write necessarily. But I had a lot more to say about other people's music. And so I think it was almost like, there's that cliche of saying, why did you decide to become a conductor? But I don't think it was that I decided. I think I was a conductor and had no idea.
Right.
And then realised, actually all these things, that ingredients, you could say, that come together. You know, because I'm sociable, I like to be around people. I also like to be quite alone and study and quite introverted.
Yep.
And those are the sort of right combination of qualities you need.
And being in control.
Being in control, but also in some way it's also the illusion of control as well, because you're part of, it's not, it's a bit like, I know people talk about analogies with like flying a plane, for example.
Yeah.
You know, if the engine,
which you wanted to do,
which I didn't want to do at one point.
Ah,
but like if the engines go,
yeah,
it doesn't matter if you don't do or don't have control. I mean, you can't fly the plane anymore. So it's more about kind of guiding the things around you in the right direction.
But you've done some of those days for me when we have open days at the theatre, when we let people conduct the orchestra for a minute maestro, we call it, you know, just queue up, you know, conduct the orchestra. And one of the things that people often say on that is, or shout out to the orchestra, go faster.
Yeah.
And you go, no, but we're following you.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a thing about how that is transmitted to people.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things at our place at Holland Park is that orchestral players and conductors get much more credit at Holland Park because they're so visible.
Mm.
And people can see it. Not only your dad and your mum and dad watching you because you're doing it, but people do think, well, that's, I can see what they're doing. I can see that you go towards the strings and they do that. And I think it's a very interesting part of the spectacle, seeing it.
Yeah,
seeing
it's very unique to the theatre.
Yeah, you can just see it and go, oh yeah, look at that, look what he's doing. He's doing that and that, and they're going quicker or they're going louder. And I think that's a really interesting thing for people that are not involved on a daily basis to see.
Yeah.
I asked your dad about coming to see you. Do you get nervous when you see your dad working?
I mean, I don't know. There's a weird sort of... I remember coming to see Death of a Salesman.
You did come and see that in Leeds.
And,
yeah.
And like, there's a weird sort of... I don't know if you have the same thing. There's a sort of almost a divide or a barrier where I don't... I never think, oh, there's my dad.
Mm.
Or like, oh, there's my dad at work.
Right.
Mm. I genuinely... can disconnect it from anything.
Well, you paid me the ultimate compliment after you'd been to see me in Death of a Salesman because you said that you forgot it was me.
Exactly.
Oh, that's great.
And that is the
that
greatest
is great.
Compliment, especially if it's your son.
Yeah, yeah, it's absolutely great.
So I was really moved
by
that.
Talk to us about that, because we said before we started recording, Philip, that's one of my personal favourite plays. What a great role.
Yeah.
It's like King Lear or something, that
it
role,
is,
isn't it?
Yeah.
What was it like playing that role?
Oh, well, it was amazing, and it wasn't as hard when I was asked to do it, and a director asked me right out of the blue, I'd never met before.
Nice.
Yeah, literally. A couple of months before, she asked to meet me in a coffee bar just for coffee to have a little chat about it. She said, I want you to play Willie Loman.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, I've not done a lot of theatre, not as much as I used to when I was younger, so I don't do it that often.
Right.
And I just thought, this is special.
Yeah.
It's also one of my favourite plays as well, as you say. So there was that. And I just thought, it was a massive challenge. I thought, this is what we came into it for.
Yeah.
However much we've done TV and film, in the beginning, we joined to do theatre.
Yeah, interesting.
So,
yeah.
The privilege of playing a part like that is, you know, without getting all lovey-dovey about it.
No, but I think,
you know,
it's right. I mean,
amazing.
I'd have given anything to have known you then, to have come and seen that, because I think you'd be amazing in that role. I can see that.
Yeah.
But I think it's one of those things when you know it so well and you've looked at it for many years, you have a, you know, almost a film of it in your mind, what it is. You know, that, you know, I can imagine that it's like some of your favourite novels. You think, I know what all the characters are like. And I just think you'd be amazing as that role.
It's an incredible play. And people in the audience used to say that at the end of it, when, you know, people are moved by it, but the end of it was mainly grown men who were in tears.
Yeah.
Because it was like their lives about hopes and dreams.
Yeah.
You know, so... it was amazing. And I mean, because the director was Sarah Esdale, because she was so good, it was structured very carefully in rehearsal. So, and I used to get up at, I think I got up about 6 at the beginning of rehearsals to learn stuff before going in.
Right,
that sounds a bit like the last minute thing that I was doing.
A bit. But, I mean, some directors these days, and I think this is completely wrong, say that the actors have to know their lines at the first reading, the beginning of rehearsals. I think that's a really bad thing, because it means you've not learnt them organically in the room with what's going on in the rehearsal.
Interesting.
I know opera singers obviously have to do that slightly more.
Yeah, but it's slightly different. I would say, because it is in our contracts, you have to be you know the music before you start.
Mm.
But also, really, in reality, it's a bit of a safety device for me, because I don't really go around checking everyone. It's just the thing that you know that they should. But
I think
you're right. You want to get in the room with the conductor and the director, and you want to know what they want from it. You know, there is a real danger, I think, in opera if you've learned it so much, which is why I don't employ a lot of singers to do roles they've done lots of times before.
Ah, right.
I like seeing what we can do with it.
Yeah.
You know, rather than I'm not coming in to do my Carmen or something. What's the point? Could have seen that anywhere else. So we'll see what we get from it.
I've seen it a lot in Germany, in the sort of repertoire houses, where you'll have a production of, you know, traditional Così fan tutte or Figaro, and
the younger characters are kind of new into the theatre, and they're doing these roles for the first time, so also maybe second time, and they're, all the ideas are there. And then you can see that the old, you know, Don Alfonso or one of the older members of the cast has just is doing his like 503rd Don Alfonso, and you can tell that the rehearsal room was young singers, lots of energy with the conductor. They're giving their
503rd. Yeah, yeah. It happens a lot, George. You see it in all the, funnily enough, in a strange way, you see it, the bigger you get, the bigger house you get, that's where you see those people flying in to do it more. Whereas at our place,
you never see it.
Some players would say, singers would say, God, the rehearsal room is too long a period. We want to come in for a week and do it.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm always, but we've got to treat it like we're doing it for the first time and get some. Put some character on it, what we want to do.
I think that's the thing. I mean, obviously, there's a technical thing in opera that is not the same as the theatre, but there's got to be something happens in the room, in the rehearsal room, that only happens there. And I always think it's better not to know too well at the beginning.
No, I think that's a good. I think that's a good way of looking at it. George, let's whiz on to the future a bit. I'm going to go back. I'm going to keep going back to the past and backwards and forwards. But let's go back to the right up to date. You conducted Figaro for us this year. As you heard me say many times on stage, it was our first performance for 636 days, which a lot of people have nicked that way of saying it since. I was saying, Philip, before you joined us, I was really conscious I had to try and get the audience to understand. It was about individual people and time and jobs this year, rather than just, oh, it's been a problem for the arts, and that was it. You know, it was over 600 days since we've performed, 250 freelancers and all that stuff, to try and make it actual.
Yeah.
I said to you, George, a few times, I said to you before we started recording today, that that dress rehearsal, you were pretty cool, because you'd done some work since lockdown, abroad. I personally, and most of the team, I don't think I've ever seen any team of mine look so nervous before that dress rehearsal in over 25 years of producing. I just thought, I've never seen so many nerves on end. How was that going back to work after all that time?
I think the thing about it is, it felt going back to normal in some way.
Mm.
I think the stage that I'm at, and I think it's probably the same for many of the colleagues who are in the cast, our lifestyle and our kind of the way that we work anyway is quite sporadic. You might have a busy period, then you might have a few weeks off, then you might have. So I think we're quite used to the stop-start thing. Mm-hmm. I imagine it would have been more difficult for people who were doing six new productions a season or something, and then suddenly had to stop.
Yeah.
I think I've always got that feeling. You know, the night before a new orchestra, for example, or the first rehearsal, it's always sleepless night, or at least, but in a positive way, because you're just excited.
Yeah.
You're looking forward to it. You can't imagine what the room's going to be like.
Yeah.
You can't imagine where the viola's going to be sitting, who's going to be the leader, how's it going to feel. But you always, within about 10 seconds, just go, okay, it's like this, and then you get into it.
Yeah.
And I think it was the same thing with that dress rehearsal.
Yeah.
I think it just felt, you're always trying to imagine what it might be like. But you get into it, and then there's no time to imagine it, you just do it.
Yeah, so I think we've got some street noise from Soho. I think for me, because I was working on that season, as you know, just at my desk for like 18 months or whatever, and it was just the same thing, imagining where we were going to be and what getting back in the room. And there was, once again, I didn't want to be too lovely about it either, but there was a real emotional moment when we stood in that rehearsal room for the first time and said, okay, this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to do it. We've got to be safe, but all that we're going to do, we're going to put on a show, where we're all used to doing that so many times, and yet suddenly it became a big deal, a much bigger deal than it should have been. But we were really all pretty excited about it. Yeah, and you did a fabulous job. Do you enjoy it?
I loved it. And what was really nice about the Figaro in particular was that it coincided. I mean, we had a big lockdown from Christmas all the way through until April, which is when we started rehearsing. And I had a couple of recording projects and things that were able to happen in that time within the lockdown.
Mm.
But actually, it was amazing, because I had so much time to study.
Uh-huh.
And it was almost like, I don't know, I mean, you can never be prepared enough for anything.
Yeah.
You know, there's always a limit where you have to say, right, now we have to get into the room. But it was just so nice going over and over and over again and again. and just kind of having the, it's a luxury to have that freedom to, to study.
Did you find with something like Mozart, and forgive you, warning Phil, I'm going to talk to you about this, that because everyone knows it so well, everyone thinks they know it so well, you had to do certain things, expectations of you that there wouldn't be in a new piece, for example.
I think the difficulty is that you have to make a lot of quite concrete decisions. You know, how are we going to get from the recit into the next number? What does andante, spiritoso, what does that really mean, or whatever it might be? And you also have to realise that every decision you make, there's going to be probably 90% of people who don't agree with that decision. And in a way, maybe it's quite sort of diplomacy or even quite political. You just have to go, this is how I'd like it to go.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you take in all the ingredients that other people offer.
Yeah.
You know, singers might want different tempi, or,
you
know, I had a great relationship with Stuart Wilde, for example, who has a massive tradition of Mozart.
Yeah.
You know, we were really working on that interpretation together as well.
Yeah.
But actually, you have to find the kind of middle ground that suits those voices and those people at the time.
I think that's right, and I think that you're right about decisions. You have to make decisions, and, you know, I keep saying about anything that we do, it's not a committee.
No,
you know, it just can't be, because you never get anyone, you never get anything done. Philip, same for you about working on roles on TV, film, or anything that other people have done before on stage. Does there come a different? Well, you know, we talked about Death of a Salesman. Does that sort of come with the history of everyone else that's done those roles, or do you not worry about that too much?
To be honest, not. And I think I mean I've not seen it that many times. To be honest, you know, I mean, I saw Warren Mitchell.
That was
pretty amazing. But I didn't remember detail of it, because it's so rich with the text. You can make it your own, you know what I mean? It didn't have that pressure. I mean, maybe with Shakespeare it is more difficult, but even then, I once played Bottom in Midsummer Night's Dream.
Nice.
I think I wasn't really aware of what other people did, and I think we were encouraged by a director who wanted to make it our own.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Not,
I do think, it's a massive generalisation, but the theatre world's still ahead of us, and the opera world in that way of no one bats an eyelid about updates of Shakespeare or what you do with it. It's just part of the thing. We're still a little bit slow on that to react and say, well, that becomes the biggest talking point, where you can do a Shakespeare setting wherever, and then everyone says, "Oh, the acting was good in that." You know. I think that just the gloss of it just tends to take over sometimes.
I mean, I think the theatre world seems to think that it has a responsibility to react to what's going on in the world of re-diversity and racial thing.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, that Ian McKellen at the age of 81 playing Hamlet is kind of.
Yeah,
maybe not quite the Hamlet you want to see, but why not?
I find with opera that in the UK we assume that the audience has never seen that opera, even if it's an opera that everybody knows.
Yeah.
If it's Marriage of Figaro, I think directors here start from a place of, let's just make sure we tell the story in a way that communicates it, whereas my experiences of working in Germany and Austria and Switzerland is that they're assuming the audience knows this piece. So what are we going to offer about this piece that's new and that's different? Which is also a great way, but you need an audience that have been going to the opera, you know, on a weekly basis since they were children, which we don't have to assume we have.
No, I think that is right. I'll come and talk about working in the Central Europe back to that in a moment as well. One thing I'm going to ask you both, because I know, George, you're on set for some of this, but Philip, I need to ask you, because it sort of crosses over both worlds slightly with one of the classic films in my mind of the last 50 years, Brastoff. I mean, it's actually a privilege to know that you're in that. I think it's an absolute masterpiece of writing and acting it. And
so
everything. You're proud of it?
Very proud of it. And it's funny you should bring it up, because it won't go away.
Right.
You know, year before last, they did a screening at the Albert Hall with live orchestra.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And that was really quite amazing. I mean, it seemed like half of South Yorkshire had decamped to the Albert Hall.
I bet they did actually. Yeah.
And you know, so it keeps coming up, and and it's not. It still works.
Oh, it really does.
It's not dated. I mean, it is dated because it's set at a different time, but it still works and it still packs an emotional.
Oh, incredible
punch.
Incredible punch. And did you, when you were filming that, did you know it was as good as it turned out? Was it obvious to you all when you were on it?
It was quite an emotional thing because we filmed it in Grimethorpe.
Yep.
And it wasn't that long after the mine had closed. I think the locals at first were a bit suspicious of it.
Yeah.
You know, the people coming up from London.
Yep.
To sort of, they weren't sure, but we got to know them. Pete Bosworth was particularly instrumental in that because he liked going down to the mine as well for the ex mine as well for club, and he liked going to local pubs. And I mean, I stood in a pub the first night we were there, and a woman said to me, "If you'd told us 5 years ago that our mine would have closed,
yeah,
we wouldn't have believed you." And she was in
right.
tears. Still.
Right.
So
well,
I mean, we
yep.
knew that we had a responsibility to make
yep.
it right and not
yep.
you know, and take it all seriously.
Oh yeah. I can imagine. Well, I didn't know him, unfortunately, but Pete Postlethwaite doing that. Again.
Oh yes,
I mean, what a performance that is
it
as
is,
well. You know,
but it was from the heart. I mean, I think all the actors really
yeah.
felt because we were right there in the middle of it.
Yeah,
they felt that.
Yeah.
yeah.
And George, you were taken on set, I hear.
I remember. Yeah. What year was Brastoff?
1993.
Okay, so I was about 7 or 8.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I do remember it, and I remember, because I remember meeting all the kids who would have been my age who were in the film.
Yeah.
Right.
And
that's
I remember
right.
us going on the bus, you know, the
yeah.
one of the last scenes where they drive through London with the
oh yeah
with all with the
that's
trophy.
Right.
Oh, right.
But
yes.
I do remember moments of that, and you know, but obviously you were up north for most of that.
Yeah, but I think you came once when we were up north.
No.
I remember going to Scarborough.
Wrong.
I remember going to Scarborough.
Oh, that's right, you did.
And me and my sister played pool against Ewan McGregor.
That's right, you did. Yeah. Who won?
That's fantastic. I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
But that was later. That was Little Voice.
Oh, that was a
yeah.
Little Voice, yeah. That was a different thing.
Oh,
but,
right.
Yeah.
But let's go back to that, because there was a great thing, you know, because obviously it's a musical film, and the
yeah.
music was judged and played beautifully. It was actually the band itself that played the music, was it? I can't remember.
It was the band. It was the local Grimethorpe band. On the literally the first morning we got up there, we had a few days rehearsal. We went to their place in Grimethorpe where they practiced, and the actors were put in amongst the musicians.
Oh, nice.
And my friend Paul Davis, who sat next to me, was a fellow tuba player, and he taught me what fingering he wrote on my on my music, what fingering was required for each note.
Yeah,
and I can sort of read music from when I
yeah.
did the violin when I was a kid, so
yeah.
I still have that a bit. And we're all sitting there chatting, getting there. Suddenly, Pete Postlethwaite walks in, picks up a baton, and starts to note here. And I was thinking, how can he do that? You know, that's phenomenal.
Yeah. My favourite moment is when you do the run through.
Yes.
And then Pete, there's a silence, and Pete Postle goes, "Crap."
Yeah, that's right.
And I've so many times I've thought, "We're
going to use that
reading,
one."
Should,
you know that.
Should you do
that?
Imagine that. Was it a load of bloody crap?
That's absolutely
it.
Brilliant.
Can you imagine saying that?
But
yes.
you obviously got to, because you don't play the tuba.
No, not at all.
But you obviously, and we've talked about this before, you obviously convinced. You know, because I remembered when I most recently saw it, it was the first time I've seen it since I've known you. I texted George and said,
yeah.
"That's your dad play." Yeah, no, I'm the expert, but it convinced me. But you've convinced.
You thought I was.
Yeah, yeah. You've convinced better people than me, though, that it was real, haven't you?
Well, you were doing a masterclass at LSO
right.
at St Luke's,
yeah.
and in the interval with Michael Tilson Thomas,
yes.
and in the interval, I remember this man sort of bounded up to me and said, "You are my favourite tuba player." I thought, "Who is this?" And it was a Patrick Harold. He's not now, but he was principal tuba player of the LSO at the time, and
fantastic.
he loves Brastoff, and
yeah,
I sort of convinced him. I think he thought I was playing.
Yeah.
I mean, Ewan McGregor played when he was younger, so
all right.
But I don't think Tara Fitzgerald didn't playing Concerto d'Arantxa, it's called Orange Juice.
Orange Juice, and
That is quite extraordinary because she wasn't playing it, and there's a lot of very close stuff on her. On the instrument,
I think even it's even more impressive that you didn't, in fact, because I think when I've always hated films, you know, I'm a very amateur compared to, you know, when I'm in with my professional friends, but I play guitar.
Right.
I hate seeing films where people play guitar and they're obviously not playing it. Right. It just feels like you couldn't be bothered to learn the and that's so, right. But you look at that, and as you said, there's a lot of close-up work and it looks great, and you just think, yeah, they're doing it. And even if they're not, in a funny way, that's even better because it looks so convincing.
I mean, I think we did it very much ourselves, of sort of getting it right. The actors did themselves with their partners, the real partners in the band.
Nice to do, yeah.
So, I mean, people weren't just sitting there going, bothering to them.
But it's great, and I think because I've spoken to a few people over the years who have been involved in mega, mega successes or very popular things, and sometimes it's a privilege for them, and sometimes it causes them problems because everyone's always wanted to talk about one particular thing. Obviously, you've got many, many things you've done, but you don't mind people bringing that bra, or including me today, bringing Brassed Up off. You know,
no, I'm proud of it. Honestly, it was a privilege to be involved in it. It really was.
Yeah.
I mean, we were very bonded as a group, and we stayed in Doncaster, which is about 10-12 miles, I think, from Grindcote. Mm-hmm. So every morning we got on a bus and went over there to work, and then came back. So we were very united, you know.
Great. Well, even though it's not you that says it, well, you're involved in something that's a catchphrase in my house with me and my wife about, you know, I've never heard him gush like that before. You know, well, we say that about lots of people in different places. Like it's like that's a catchphrase in our place. But George, let's come back to you on this about work. You've referred to it a few times, and I have, about working Central Europe. Was that a choice because more openings, more opportunities to move on quicker? You know, how did that come about that you did so much work in Central Europe?
I mean, I think it really comes from the fact that I did most of my education in Austria, and within a system that kind of fed into, well, particularly Austria, but the German-speaking countries. And then one of my first kind of significant jobs as an assistant conductor was then in Paris, which sort of opened up, was a reference for France. And I think with conducting and with sort of classical music in a way, it's moves at quite a glacial pace sometimes. It takes time to be known and then to be invited to then to work. And so really what you're doing is you're building upon all the different attributes of the things that you've done and that you know. I think language is important. Mm-hmm. You know, luckily I speak 3 or 4 different languages that allow me to work in those countries.
Did you learn those before you started working, or did you pick those up when you started working? You had to learn languages as you went.
I mean, I learned French as a kid at school, and French was okay, but then I had to relearn it later on. German, you taught me on a ferry. Do you remember? Because you drove me to. Do you remember? You drove me to Ireland. Because I was going back to university, and on the one of the sick bags on the ferry, you wrote out the numbers because I'd already had
forgotten that.
I already had this feeling that as a conductor, you need to have piano. I didn't have the piano at all. You need to have languages. I didn't have any languages.
Yeah.
So I was from about 19 or 20. I knew that I had to work out what the deficits were and find them.
But
and that was one of them because of course
I did German. But certainly when you got the acceptance from Vienna, from conservatoire in Vienna, you had to learn German quickly as a it was mandatory for you to do an exam, the B1 exam, wasn't it? So you learned very quickly, and then you spent a few weeks actually in the closed university doing a language course to get that.
I think I did my entrance exam with Ein Bier bitte, and I understood. They asked me
noch ein Bier bitte.
But I remember that we had an interview, and they said, "So you want to come to Vienna?" And then one of the other teachers said, "Yeah, okay, warum?" And I remembered that warum was why. And that was the extent of my German at that point. And then it was like, okay, you have a place to study conducting here. only if you pass this exam.
Yeah.
In those circumstances, you learn the language.
It's very interesting.
I've known you for a good few years now, but I didn't know you got very analytical and what needs to be done mind, haven't you? From everything you've said this morning, that needs to be done now.
Yeah.
Look at the deficits.
Yeah.
What I need to do and get that. That is great. A great attitude and ability to have.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's what we do. You know, in a rehearsal, you think right. Here's the list of things that we could improve on. What are the priorities of that? What needs addressing first? What will fix itself? Mm-hmm. I think actually, going back to the dress rehearsal, a lot of the time you think actually just playing it all through helps, and then you know what needs to change. But most of it will solve itself.
Yeah,
I think it's quite a pragmatic job.
Yeah,
conducting. You know, it's really just probably like being a director. Often it's just okay. Mm-hmm. How do we get this to be as good as it can be?
I think it's very similar. I mean, I work like that a lot. I think in my job, it's also the thing of all the sort of sports psychology I do take on about marginal gains. You know, it's very unlikely that I can make 20% improvement to a show or whatever. But if I make or help people make 2% improvement on that bit there, and 2% on that, or making, you know, I've talked to you a lot about keeping artists happy, and not to say it's a wrapped in cotton wool sort of, you know, mollycoddled thing.
Yeah.
It's just that in my mind, because I've seen it from both ways for people I worked for when I was young producing, that if you take all the problems out of the way, obstacles that other people have got, you've got a clearer run at it.
And if
the artist is not worrying about their call sheets, which is why we do rehearsal schedules in advance, quite heavily in advance. Mm. They're not worried about being paid on time to be paid quickly.
Mm.
All that sort of stuff. It doesn't mean that their life is easy, but it means you've taken some percentage of problems away from their everyday existence.
Mm. Good thinking.
To say, okay, now you've got more space, that couple of percent, to think about what you're doing.
What's important,
what you're doing. And I think it's just sort of basic stuff for me, and I try and look at that often. In, you know, and I've said this a lot over the years, that I have to change the metaphor now as well as the actions. But I've always said, you know, part of my job is knowing when someone needs an arm around them and knowing when someone needs a kick. You can't put your arm around anyone or kick anyone. But the thing still is the same, that everyone is different, and some people do need a real rocket to say, come on, pull yourself together, and other people need to say, what are the problems? Is something bothering you that I can help with or not, or can someone on my team help you? And it's just about that person management to see what that things need. So it's very similar, analysing it and saying, they're going to look after themselves, that's fine, but what can we improve, rather than just go, well, it's all okay. You know, just looking at it slightly differently.
That's very wise. I wish more people in the theatre had that kind of
attitude, to be honest. But I think that's very nice of you to say, but I think it's also, as Jules's phrase there, it's pragmatic. You know, how can I get better
work from people? Yeah, that's all you want, isn't it? To make it better.
Make it better.
Yeah.
And I think that if you've got people worrying about paying their rent or whatever, that's a very obvious thing. They're not going to be out of focus on the work as much as other things. And I think it's just about trying to say, you know, this is a hard job anyway. All of our jobs are hard. Okay, it's not like we're talking about going down the mine and you know, thing. But they're all hard jobs. But how do we make that easier for everyone or more straightforward, and then get more enjoyment out of it?
But I also wonder whether, in the same way for all of our jobs, I don't think there's a lot of glory in the successes, in the sense that, you know, usually as a conductor, you kind of don't want to be noticed, particularly in opera, because it's not, you know, you're in a pit. But actually, if you're noticed, it's usually bad. And I think it's the same with a lot of you know, you notice bad acting perhaps more quickly than you might notice great acting. And obviously, we focus on the people who are fantastic. But actually, for me, what's more important is, okay, let's not be awful. That's kind of the first thing. But actually, it shouldn't be. You have to be so kind of confident in what you do that you don't mind not getting loads of praise.
Yeah.
You know, it's self-fulfillment. You're the one that has to go, yeah, I thought that went really well, but you don't look for it from somewhere else.
Yeah, interesting. I think I wish more people thought like that. But I think that it is an interesting thing. I mean, you know, my thing is standing at the back and watching it all happen. And it is a bit like a football manager or something. You only really notice my job if it's going wrong, and then
exactly.
But so I do get that. But I think that there's a real pleasure in making that happen. I mean, it's an interesting thing about psychology doing artistic jobs, which is why I was intrigued to talk to you both. And I've probably get nowhere near the depth I wanted to from the questions I've asked, but I just think having that artistic line running through your family, that must be a good thing about understanding what the other one's going through at different times, must it?
Oh yes, very much so. Yeah, and I mean, seeing George turn up in these places and do, you know, pretty hefty stuff is like reminds you of when you've done, you know, demanding things as a performer, certainly. And so we understand that. Start off from a basis of understanding it.
Yeah, and I think that thing of just about having support, because it is the understanding of, because, you know, I know people that are not in the business that, and they say, what's your week like? And I'd start saying, and I thought, I'm going to stop because it doesn't really make sense. And that's absolutely fair. Phil, how has it affected your direct work in this last 20 months with the lockdown? Did you have jobs cancelled because of when COVID hit?
Well, when it hit, I was rehearsing a play, The Dumb Waiter. I was going to play at the Hampstead Theatre. And the lockdown happened literally the night before we were due to go into the theatre to start the technical. So it was like 3 days before the first preview.
Oh, God.
So that was the end of that. They did revive it in November, and I thought it was the wrong time because the figures were going up again, and I didn't think it was right. And they did open it with a different cast. But I think after about 10 days they had to close, so that was in December, November, December. I didn't do any visual work, literally, as opposed to sound, voice work, between then and this June.
Right.
So that's a year and a quarter.
Yeah.
I did quite a bit of radio and the odd sort of voiceover thing.
Including a lovely thing for us with
that
the
visual.
That was visual. I forgot. But I wasn't picking
was
up on
thing.
That.
But that's the only thing.
Well, even more of a brilliant. You read that poem so beautifully, but I remember you doing it. And this is the thing about different jobs, George, as well. Philip read it, and I said, "That's it, done."
Yeah.
Let me do it again, and it's perfect. You don't need to do it, but it was a real pleasure seeing someone like you work.
It's probably my favourite Christmas carol, really, the Christmas song. Well, it's a poem, isn't it? I just didn't want to mess it up for you.
It was absolutely brilliant.
So I did that. So literally, I didn't do anything. I set up a little recording corner at home, so I could do radio and stuff, because we did quite a lot of radio stuff with the actors all at home and the directors somewhere else. On Zoom calls.
How was that?
It worked rather well, actually. You can't hear it. You can't hear the joints.
No, nice.
You know, it's sort of worked. So, but literally, I didn't do a proper job from March until June of this year. March 2020 to June this year.
Wow.
So
yeah,
that's a long time not to do
it. It is tough, isn't it? It's really... And George, cancellations for you obviously came thick and fast at that point.
Funny enough, it was almost the same situation that you had. I was about to open a new world premiere of a new opera in Vienna at Theater an der Wien, which was by an Austrian composer called Tschol-Theisen. And it was a sort of jazz storytelling of Beethoven's life, because it was, of course, the Beethoven year, 2020. And we did a dress rehearsal, and then our premiere got delayed for some technical reasons to do with the opening. So we didn't open when we were supposed to. The second night turned into the dress rehearsal, public dress rehearsal, and then the day after the public dress, Austria announced the cancellation of all theatre. So they allowed us to do a private opening night to an audience, and they filmed it. So it was an audience, which was lovely, because we did it knowing that was it.
Yeah.
And we were the only, I think they'd cancelled everything at the other theatres in Vienna.
Yeah.
And so we knew that we were the last thing happening, which was kind of really weird and kind of special feeling. And then the next day we all left, but we got told, it was interesting looking back, we got told, we're going to keep your contract so that in 2 weeks you can come back.
In 2 weeks,
and finish off the run.
So I was
a bit optimistic.
I almost was going to leave half of my stuff there and come back. But of course, it became pretty clear that, because we were so close to the Italian border until where it was really happening, you know, North Italy, the Alps, and everything.
That's right.
So it was quite, the Austrians were quite on it compared to us. It took us a bit longer to get the sense of it. You know, and then, what was interesting actually, orchestras
and opera houses, I suppose, were more going in the direction of postponements than cancellations at the beginning.
Yeah.
Which was really nice because it means that this season feels a little bit like a deja vu of what last season was, which is really kind of special because you feel like you've actually... Because, funnily enough, I was talking to a couple of other conducting colleagues. It wasn't to do with the sort of income or the, you know, the loss of income or anything like that was the stress. It was like these artistic projects that you've really focused on for a long time. You know, we know what we're doing sometimes 2 years in advance.
Yeah.
And so losing those, that was really the sort of pain of it rather than anything else.
It was very difficult. I remember when I had to cancel the 2020 season, which we went quite early because we had to... stop building our theatre because that was going to cost too much money. And I remember getting some criticism, including one email that's very famous in our office that I got of saying, "You'll have to work hard to get my support back after you've caved in so quickly."
Oh, really?
And, and then, you know, 2 weeks later, everything was closed. So, you know, we could see it coming.
Yeah.
But even when I was cancelling all of the season, I rang as many people as I could personally. I ran out of time. I couldn't get to everyone. We had to put the announcement out, but then I mailed everyone. But it was really upsetting time because you'd done all that work for 2 years on this planning, and then you didn't know when they were going to come back. But at that point, I was still saying to everyone, maybe we'll get them on in the autumn. We'll take a theatre. You know, you had no idea the scale that was going to come along. Philip, so is it changing now, though? Is it opening up again, work now?
Yes, it is. I mean, there's a lot, certainly a lot going on. I mean, you know, obviously aware of the theatre's opening, but even on, I mean, there's a lot of filming going on, I know that, but everybody's being affected by new cases.
Yeah.
And when we started the thing, I just finished in June, and like 4 days in, the director tested positive.
Oh.
So that shut us down for 10 days.
Oh, right.
And so that's been kind of on hanging over everything, I think, all through the summer.
Yeah.
And they've done all right. I think they're going to finish on time. It's a long project, but they had a thing in everybody's contract. I don't know whether you've had anything like this, where although you had a stop date for when you actually finish your work, there was a 2-week insurance period in case there was a delay because of COVID.
No, I didn't know. Right, interesting.
So they didn't have to invoke that in the end, but. Okay. That's quite a common thing.
Yeah, I mean, it is changing a lot, and I think contracts are going to be looked at in so many different ways about what it is. But George, also when we were doing the figure in the summer, I remember actually you and I talking about this one particular night, that even after everything all three of us have said about how strange it was, it quickly became okay and normal again, didn't it? You know, and when we were having a drink after the show, sitting outside, some colleagues around, we did all of our stuff outside this year. The theatre's obviously outside, but we had the bar outside mostly, so you could feel more comfortable and safer. And just sitting after a long night of Figaro, you're sitting there, drink and chatting, and I think, this is nice.
Yeah.
Sort of the normality felt good, didn't it? Quickly.
Well, I think we've all learned not to take normality for granted because. You know, if you, I think we how many before was it 12?
12, I think.
And actually, you know, of course, there's a rhythm of every run of operas.
Yeah,
you know, where you know you get a slight dip in the middle, and then there's suddenly like the eighth night, you're like, wow, that was really exciting.
Yeah.
You know, it really varies on the audiences and how it works. Yeah. But you have to remember when you're going in and you're tired and you've had a you know between projects and you think actually no. This is something which we're privileged to be able to do in the best of circumstances, let alone in the current climate.
I think that's right. I disagree with you there slightly because I think that figure I built it almost entirely in a direct upwards thing. I think it got really good, very quickly, and then it kept growing. And I think particularly with our audience liking it so much, which is not always the case when anyone tries a Mozart, because as I said earlier, they've all got their own opinions on it. But to be pleasing an audience that much as we were then, I think with the Mozart, it was really terrific. And it was great coming in every night and having, okay, we had reduced capacity heavily, but selling out shows every night, seeing a full audience all enjoying themselves with that, and Traviata on alternate nights, just had a lovely feel. And you know, this is the last thing I'm going to ask you about this year's work. You're the first conductor of that season to deal with the orchestra pit being in the middle of the stage, which me and Takis, our designer, created. I mean, obviously I loved it. How was it for you?
I loved it because it felt like, I mean, there's a famous ring cycle from Amsterdam, Pierre Audi, I think, which has the orchestra as this sort of extra character in the middle of the stage. And it reminded me of that production. Because, you know, what's interesting with Mozart is that more so than Handel or anything previously in the 18th century, suddenly the orchestra is so involved in commenting on what's happening. You know, there might be a trill in the violas that suggests the count flirting or something. And it, so you realise, actually, this is the other character in the room.
Nice.
And I really enjoyed that. And I think also the orchestra really enjoyed having that direct contact with the singers slightly more than usual.
I really, Philip, you came in obviously to see the show George conducting. How was it in that theatre for you? Because you obviously work in theatre a lot, in films and everything.
Sure, I mean, I was going to say that the way you'd organise the distancing in the audience was very good. I mean,
you feel comfortable.
Very comfortable, and also you felt connected to other people because you knew everybody was in the same boat, and it was slightly odd at first, but then you thought, no, this is well done, and you know, it was just a good.
Yeah,
you're just aware that everybody was excited and glad to be there, so you gave that before you started. Just
I think that's absolutely right, because I think that there is still a mountain to climb here for confidence in being in indoor theatres with everyone in 100% thing. I think there is a mountain to climb on that safety wise. I mean, I worry about it, so I think that having that at the beginning, that we're in the open air, you're distanced from people, close enough to get the communal experience of watching a piece together, close enough to talk to your neighbours if you so wished, but also enough space to feel they're not all over me, you know.
I think I was very aware of the, or I realised that I wasn't as confident about coming into some West End theatres, which are Victorian theatres that haven't got a lot of room. And we went to see the musical Six.
That's right. Oh,
right. The Six Wise Men of the Eighth, musical. And when was that? Kind of
That was in the middle of the run. So it was
May, was it?
Yeah, no, June.
Or June, And I don't know. I mean, I wasn't aware of any. Everybody seemed to be on top of each other in the audience. I sort of found it a bit odd because those theatres are pretty cramped anyway. So
It is an issue for the West End, I think.
I think it is. And the fact that you had the open air space and that sort of thing was really good. I mean, I did look at you sometimes when you obviously were the orchestra's there and the characters there, that you, when they were behind you in the apron at the front of the thing, you had to sort of
move around.
Use your
a bit
neck
more.
A lot.
I did have a very nice massage after that.
but I didn't get the impression it was
used to using the shoulders.
I didn't think it was cramping your style.
I think it's like we were saying when you first introduced the theatre. It was like, actually, you think, well, yeah, it's like that's like doing a concert performance where the singers would be behind you.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, I think that's totally.
But two things. I know that one of my other conductors, Matt Waldron, who was doing the Traviata, his wife said to him afterwards, "Now I can see why you've got a bad neck." But I remember when I first showed it to you, George, as you said, I remember you saying to me, because obviously I'm, Philip, I'm showing the directors and conductors wanting, not justification because we were making decisions, but wanted their buying into it. And George was one of the first people who said, you'd be out of almost... hear them breathe was your phrase you say to me when they're behind me. I can almost hear them breathe, they'll be fine. And that gave me a lot of confidence at the time. It's like, okay, we can, you know, people are going to work in different ways, but this is the best way for us to go as a company. If you get people like you buying into it and understanding it, it was always going to be easier. And so I really thank you for that. It gave me one of the first bits of confidence on
good. But that's interesting that you mentioned that, because do you remember we came to see, what was the piece that you did? Is it a Schumann piece with a singer, and I, because the singer was in front, it was a concert.
Okay.
Was it in Dublin?
I've no idea.
Kinder
Tortenlieder.
Yes.
Yes, with Gavin Wynne.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
And
Gavin,
I was amazed how he was in front of you.
Yeah.
And how you always looked when he was about you.
Yeah.
And I remember asking you about it, and said it was all to do on the breaths.
Yeah.
On breath.
You
could hear each other in that way. I was absolutely fascinated.
It's a fascinating thing to look at. But I say, George, it really helped me at that point, because I was at home working with Takis, the brilliant designer. on Zoom for months, and then when I started filtering it out to the the team, it's like, okay, what are they going to say? Yeah. And but it worked.
Every theatre has certain difficulties, whether it's a very deep pit or a very wide pit, or whether it's sight problems, or you know. And actually, most of as I said, pragmatic. You just have to go, right, here are the problems in this space. Let's solve them. And
yeah,
that's you know. Luckily, we were able to rehearse in the theatre.
Yeah,
well before.
Mm. Well, I think that was the thing. I always, my wife will listen to this and she'll say, "You didn't correct George, so I'm going to have to." Mm. It's never lucky, because we knew we had to have you rehearsing there to get as much opportunity to use the new space.
Yeah,
but it was interesting when we moved to shows 3 and 4 that then all the problems started again, because they were new to it.
Yeah.
The Traviata and the Figaro teams have got so used to it, it felt second nature. But then the next two shows in, we're like, this is weird.
This
you
is
know,
weird,
you have to
yeah.
start it again. So you know, it's a constant thing of learning and you know, trying to get the best out of you know, an awful situation. Anyway, I better let you two go. Listen, what I could sit here and
I've
talk to you both all day.
But
listen, George and Philip, thank you so much for spending the time with me today. It's been great talking to you. It's great hearing the insights. And I probably will listen back and thought, I should have asked them out of that. So maybe we'll have to do a round two later in the year.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it, really.
Yeah. Philip and George, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
You have been listening to From the Producer's Office, a series of informal podcasts with James Clutton. For more information on Opera Holland Park, please visit www.operahollandpark.com.